Hey everyone, and welcome to this special Snake Oilers edition of the Risky Business Podcast. My name's Patrick Gray. Snake Oilers isn't the regular Risky Business Podcast. If you're looking for that one, just scroll back to one of the numbered episodes in our podcast feed, because no, Snake Oilers is the wholly sponsored podcast series we do here at Risky.biz, where vendors give us money so that they can come onto the show and pitch you their sweet, sweet snake oil. And we got three snake oilers for you today. First up, we'll be hearing from Australia's very own Airlock Digital, whitelisting made easy. And then we'll hear from the man, the legend, Mark Rogers of Okta. He'll be telling us about a new feature from Okta. It was released late last year, as best I can tell, as well as generally just giving the stump pitch for Okta's services, which, you know, is a pretty compelling pitch now that your workforce isn't allowed into the building anymore. Then we're going to hear from Kaseya's John Emmett, who'll be trying to convince you all that their VSA endpoint management agent is what you all need to get your remote workforce computers wrangled and herded into some sort of semblance of order. So yeah, let's kick it all off now with David Cottingham of Airlock Digital. David is one of the founders there. And what can I say? I am a genuine fan of what these guys do. You may have heard them on the show before. They've been in a weekly show before, and they were on Snake Oilers, I think, last year as well. And they've made whitelisting software that is actually usable, which on its own, is a real achievement. But they've done more with it than just that. They've built a bunch of host hardening into their agent. So, you know, bypasses for whitelisting software, same as for AV and EDR, those sort of bypasses, have been around for a long time. There's various bypass techniques. But, you know, what Airlock have done is killed all the lol bins. You know, if customers select that option, they kill the lol bins on Windows boxes. And that really does ruin pen tester party time most of the time, right? So they've just taken a bunch of really sensible steps with their software. And also on the host hardening stuff, they've mapped out a bunch of those hardening features and hardening options to the MITRE ATT&CK matrix. So that is pretty cool as well. Now, if you are a regular listener, you may have heard a while ago that Airlock Digital software has been published to the CrowdStrike like app store thing. And as it turns out, CrowdStrike plus Airlock is actually a pretty sweet combo. Airlock stops attackers moving around, and CrowdStrike will see them if they somehow manage to do it. So, you know, the point is you're going to have a lot less activity to look at through CrowdStrike if you are using Airlock Digital in concert, right? So the moral of the story is, if you are a CrowdStrike customer, go get yourself an Airlock Digital trial. David Cottingham joined me for this interview, and I started off by asking why CrowdStrike customers are digging Airlock's vibe. And here's what he had to say.
So I think it's really the ability to control the execution of their environment, right? So I think in particular, the ability to not only stop the things that they don't want to happen, you know, quite often things like administrators doing TeamViewer and using remote access tools and things like that to do remote unsolicited support into their environment, but also to, you know, proactively prevent all the things that they don't know about as well. So, you know, being able to have a really granular control over everything that's executing, and also correlating that with actually why that occurred on the CrowdStrike side, you know, so they can see, well, how did this execution happen in the first place, this file that I don't know about? They can see all the telemetry leading up from that from CrowdStrike, and then they can see this, you know, the proactive prevention of that unknown thing on the Airlock side, which has been really exciting for us.
Yeah, I mean, you know, CrowdStrike is all about reducing that time to remediate, right? And I guess adding, you know, bolstering the controls so that you've got less to remediate in the first place are probably something that a lot of people are going to like.
Yeah, exactly. So I think there's been a lot of merit in having that proactive prevention, that control of sort of your whole execution stack. You know, it's really, really important. And it's about, for us, I guess our focus is about limiting the options that attackers have. So, you know, attackers, if you get eyes on the attackers, you can see what they're doing, how they're behaving. It's really, really valuable. But then you're taking away their ability to execute pretty much anything that's not already there in the environment, forcing them to live off the land. There's pretty much no room for them to move anymore without either being seen or being prevented.
Living off the land is a little bit difficult in an environment that you've had access to, though, David, because I understand that Airlock actually does quite restrict the way you can use certain things, you know?
Yeah, exactly. And we've improved that a lot recently in our latest 4.5 release, where we can now more granularly look at, you know, how multiple applications can call other applications. I know in our previous interview, I gave the example of, you know, controlling the way the WMI queries work, you know, restricting certain applications to only being able to use that functionality in Windows. That's been something that people, you know, to be honest, they're only really just starting to get around to harnessing within their product, because a lot of people now are at the roadmap where they're, you know, they're really finishing up getting their sort of mature base application whitelisting deployment. And now they're sort of ratcheting it up to that next level where they're thinking about behaviors, they're thinking about bypasses.
Yeah. They're thinking about scripts, they're thinking about weird lol bins all over their Windows boxes that really, why have them there, you know?
Exactly right. We actually added pretty recently into the product also .NET execution environment support. So what we're doing is we're now actually looking at the loading of, you know, arbitrary .NET applications,
which is if you want to bypass whitelisting, it's very handy to be able to do that sort of thing, right?
Exactly. Pretty much every second lol bin is just, you know, using reflection with .NET straight into memory. So it's a massive win for us.
Yeah, no, that's cool. You know, and this is the thing. You're doing some cool stuff here. Now, I know that you already had, making Airlock administrable from the cloud. That was already on the roadmap. You initially designed this software to be used on-prem, right? Mm-hmm. Obviously, everybody now needs to be like off-prem because of the COVID-19 crisis. So I know basically you guys just disappeared for the last month or so while you've been working on that. Is it up and running yet? Are people able to use this for their remote workforce?
Yes, yeah, definitely. We've seen a big sort of shift of many customers to, you know, not only signing on but also buying new endpoint licenses to accommodate their shift actually to off-premise. So we've also just won a grant from our friends at OSCyber to actually develop or redevelop our cloud solution to help with that onboarding process. So in the future, once we finish this project, it's basically, you know, modernizing our whole cloud stack is so people will be able to just go to the website, sign up, you know, and basically to multi-tenant our solution. So things like MSPs can actually manage multiple customers, which will be, you know, great new functionality and provide really quick onboarding flexibility for our customers. So at the moment, you know, there's obviously a sales cycle that they need to jump through, and we're just trying to cut that down as much as possible with this new stack.
Yes, frictionless.
Yes,
as frictionless as possible, as the VC types like to say. Basically,
exactly right.
Now, look, you know, you've got a bit of a stump speech that you've been working on lately, just about whitelisting in general. And I mean, this is the sell your stuff segment, right, on Snake Oilers. So give it to us, right? Like, what's your best pitch for Airlock Digital right now?
Yeah, so I guess it's really the reason why we started the company in the first place. So application whitelisting was difficult. We were frustrated as security practitioners going around to different organizations implementing these hack together solutions. And we didn't really want to live that life forever. So we basically decided to build our own platform. And we found that there were four sort of key requirements for application whitelisting deployments to be successful. And that is, one, you need centralized visibility of everything going on. You would be surprised at how many application whitelisting deployments people put out there where they don't actually have centralized logging. They'll just push out a rule set and leave it. But obviously that creates problems, right? You know, you can't see that. Well, the first time you hear about something being blocked is when a user calls you up. And if that's happening, then you've basically already lost, because the user resistance is gonna push the project back.
Man, I'm going to interrupt you just to tell you a quick story from the trenches, right? This is a few years ago now, but like an admin I know was using Sophos whitelisting, right? And this is years ago before you guys existed. And I'm like, how is it? He said, it's okay, you know, like it works reasonably well. But the thing is, if you actually try to go in and customize it too much, they keep moving the categories around and it keeps breaking the rules. And this is, you know, and then he has to start from scratch and go and pointy clicky and sort of rebuild it. I mean, this guy was managing a sort of medium-sized corporate network. And, you know, he could live with it, but it was just so painfully obvious that the whitelisting stuff was kind of like developed with no thought for how people were actually going to use it. And this seems to have been the whitelisting thing. You either had people like, you know, Bit9 who tried to go big, kind of missed the mark and then pivoted into something else. And, you know, here we are, Carbon Black, whatever. And then you got the AV people who develop whitelisting to say that it's something that they've got, whereas, you know, it's not really something that they've necessarily invested a lot of time and thought into. Whereas your stuff is, you know, really just trying to be that niche player in usable whitelisting. How did I do pitching your stuff?
Well, that's it. I mean, I guess it's been an interesting journey. I mean, we've really had the benefit of having that experience of seeing what the rest of the market has done before we've actually spun up. And I mean, we've lived through with, you know, those solutions that you've mentioned, some of the pitfalls, and were able to actually design something from scratch that solved those challenges from the outset, which is really, you know, been extremely valuable for us. And I guess one of the biggest things that we've done in the product is, you know, it's based largely on hash values. Well, a big part of the rule set is hash values, right? But you never really see a hash value in the product. And that's sort of intentional, because a hash value means a lot to a machine, but it doesn't really mean anything to a human, you know, unless you're doing file comparisons and things like that. So, you know, when you're going through and building those rule sets, you're sort of handling sort of execution data rather than the actual hash values themselves. So you can actually build up really granular, massive trust lists that look huge in most other bits of software where you've got, you know, 20,000 hash values. But, you know, we're wrapping that in a workflow just to make that sort of point and click and really quick to do, even though you don't really know that you're managing those things.
I mean, you know, I got to say, like, one of the ways that I describe your software to other people, because, you know, you and I and some of the other guys who work for Airlock, like, we talk like pretty regularly. It's not just these interviews, because I find what you're doing really interesting, right? And I like to hear more about it. And I guess one thing that a set of words that I use to describe what you're doing is, I don't use whitelisting. I say you're basically an instrumentation platform that lets you decide what can and can't run on your systems, right? And there's so much you can do once you have that control of, like, complete control over whatever binary you want to run. I mean, you could even plumb up this system theoretically, and I know, you know, I doubt this is on your roadmap or whatever, but, you know, you could do a lot to automate some of the decision-making for pass-fail to your whitelist, and this is an approach that would work so much better than traditional AV in so many circumstances.
100%, yeah. So we're looking at opportunities, you know, and it's something that, you know, we've definitely discussed ourselves. It's like opportunities for instrumentation around the outside of that platform. So, you know, we've got a really small agent, a really small database, and if we can populate that with sensible choices and put that choice in the control of the consumer, most importantly, because, you know, when you've got an endpoint protection product and you buy it off the shelf, really it's just a black box. You're just installing that and you're going, trust in the security gods that, you know, the engineers behind this will protect me. And you don't get any visibility into that. So, you know, we're looking at ways of basically engineering the stack so you can put in the trust in what you trust.
And you can threshold it, right? So you can say, like, okay, Airlock Digital Decision Agent, if you are 100% sure that this thing is cool, run it. If you are even a little bit sus on it, kick it up to someone for manual review, dump it into a sandbox, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, exactly. And then people can sort of set those thresholds depending on how their, you know, what their experience level is, what their resource level is, you know. So there's huge opportunities, you know, we can definitely see in this space. And, you know, it's something that we are working towards.
Now, it's really interesting too. You think about the CrowdStrike stuff. Does it surprise? This is the great thing about the security market now, is it's becoming more modular, right? Isn't it great that you can just be deployed alongside a fairly sophisticated EDR agent and then, you know, the customer gets that whole capability? That's great.
Yeah. Oh, it's fantastic. Yeah. CrowdStrike's been brilliant for us, you know, in terms of just even if it's just the solve that deployment challenge, right? Like, you know, getting the software into the customer, getting it out there and being able to just make it work and run, you know, efficiently and well. And also then we're working, you know, over the next 6 months to bring the products, you know, closer together. So, you know, we're sharing more and more execution and telemetry data so we can see when, you know, our product versus CrowdStrike took a particular action, correlate that. And then, you know, you can not only see the value that you're getting from both products, but
but it's a bit of a signal boost as well, right? When both of them are like, warp, warp, warp.
Yeah, exactly right. Yeah. That's it. Yeah.
That makes a lot of sense. You could just deploy right now. If you're a CrowdStrike customer, you just go into their like app store and then grab your stuff and that's it, right? They don't even need to interact with you at all.
Yeah, you just click request trial and then it just spins everything up, gives you access automatically, and then you can just start deploying.
Wonderful. All right, Dave Cottingham, thank you very much for joining us. I understand you're a little foggy at the moment because you have a wonderful new little baby in the house, 1 month old. Congratulations. Yes,
thank you very much. Yeah, it's definitely shout out to everyone out there that's managing little ones at the moment in these interesting times that we have. It can be challenging. Yeah,
it can. But I think at this stage, it's pretty much shout out to anyone who's ever had a baby before. My God, you forget how much work they are.
Oh, yes. Oh, this. Yeah, it's a lot of work. Yeah,
it is a lot of work. All right, Dave Cottingham, thank you so much for joining us. And of course, we'll be talking to you again here and there throughout the year.
Yeah, thanks so much, Patrick. Cheers.
That was David Cottingham of Airlock Digital there. Big thanks to him for that. And you can check them out at airlockdigital.com. Okay, next up, we are going to hear from Mr. Mark Rogers, the Executive Director of Cybersecurity at Okta. And any way you slice or dice it, Okta is a leader in the whole SSO / CASB space. You know, they are an authentication broker, cloud authentication broker, whatever you want to call them. You know what they do. And they have never been more relevant than right now, right? Because authentication plays like Okta are zero trust enablers. And that's what we're all about right now because of the pandemic. Mark joined me to talk through a couple of things. They've recently launched a feature, which is like passwordless logins. They want to promote that. And he also talked me through what he's been seeing out there in the enterprise over the last few weeks. Here's Mark Rogers.
Okta has launched some new products. Probably the biggest one to talk about here is FastPass. And the movement away from using actual passwords for authentication. But it really ties into just the kind of whole story of Okta and the movement towards the cloud. What we're seeing now during the pandemic is that a ton of companies have been blindsided. Very few companies had real pandemic reports or planning in place to deal with the situation. They're struggling to cope with the fact that their workforces are massively distributed. And they're being pushed towards using SaaS services out of pure necessity.
Yeah.
Because you can't maintain a stack of servers if you can't get access to the building.
it's true. It is true.
And likewise, like, if you've got all your workforce distributed, you need to have tools that support collaboration in a distributed fashion. But if you try and cut the corners on that, it goes horribly wrong. And we've seen scenarios like people doing things like exposing a remote desktop to the internet without a VPN and trying to create some kind of online collaboration method that way. Cutting corners ends up ending the way you would expect. They're getting pwned. We're seeing breaches left, right, and center. Bad guys are going after everything they can get their hold of. Some of it is probably because the bad guys are bored and sitting at home and just doing what they can.
Yeah.
But some of it's because they also recognize that companies have never been this vulnerable as they are now. Mm. You know, if you get owned in a normal environment, you can go to your security department and give them your laptop and ask them for help. But what do you do if you click on a phishing email and something nasty gets installed on your laptop when you're sitting at home? You know, getting someone to remotely remediate that is a nightmare. And so
there's problems, right? Like, there's a lot of this stuff that we've been talking about on the show the last few weeks. I mean, you know, you got the issue of managing endpoints. You got the issue of, well, hang on, are they even company owned endpoints? Is there a BYOD policy that would let the company run some sort of management agent so that the thing can actually patch? You know, is your antivirus set up to actually grab new definitions from something on the internet, or is it supposed to be grabbing stuff off the internal gateway? Like, there's just so much. But, you know, one of the big swings obviously is towards this more zero trusty stuff. And Okta is, of course, Okta and its ilk are a key plank in this thing. But I'm curious, look, I do want to steer this conversation back towards what it is that you've launched. You mentioned that you've got some sort of passwordless product. What is that? How does it work?
So it's part of the core Okta movement, which is that, as you mentioned, zero trust is sort of the answer. People have been moving towards not using passwords for a while. You know, we had simple passwords, then we had complicated passwords, then we stuck them in password managers. Now, machines are already managing our passwords. So if you're going down that route, why not let the machine handle everything? Yeah. Why not just have an application that is tied cryptographically into the infrastructure, so that when someone goes to do an authentication, they click a button on the application, and then the machines take care of proving that authentication, passing the information back and forth, and ensuring that it's the right person that's doing it. You've not actually lost anything. Mm. You're still using strong tokens. You're still using SAML flow to do the authentication. But all that's been taken out of the loop is the human. And if you take the human out of the loop, then what are the phishing emails going to collect? There's no passwords for them to steal anymore. And on top of that, even if they're able to get something in that process, they still have to be able to mimic all of the things that are going on, because now you can build stuff like context into it. So when he pressed the button, was the device he was using the legitimate device that's being registered? Is he doing it from a country that we would expect him to be doing it from? Is he accessing resources he's supposed to be accessing? Are there any other policy requirements? You can bake all of that into the authentication, and suddenly you end up with a really difficult scenario for a bad guy to break.
Well, and this is the thing, right? Each one of those things that you just mentioned on their own are not nearly as good as a password, but you start adding them all together and, you know, it starts looking pretty good.
Yeah, exactly. And you can also start baking stuff like biometrics into it.
Well, I mean, and this is the iPhone approach, right? When I pull out my phone and I need to do a transaction, I'm not entering passwords. It scans my face. My banking app scans my face. Saves me an awful lot of time. It's great.
Right. But this is more than that, because, you know, biometrics on their own also can be broken. Right? Your face can be photographed. Your fingerprints can be collected if you leave them on a glass that you touch, and so on and so forth. But if you turn them all into context and you marry them with all this other information, suddenly you end up with a decision process that is so well informed that A, it's transparent, so the bad guys don't know what factors have been involved in the decision, but B, it's incredibly difficult to replicate even if you know what they are.
Mm, because you actually have to have those things.
Yeah. Exactly.
No, it makes sense. So what is this? I mean, is this just a option for your core product? I mean, is, you know, what's the idea here, that people will be doing passwordless logins into their Salesforce, or, you know, like how's this working? You know, who's this for? Like, I mean, can you give us some real world applications for this?
So I mean, this is basically for any of our customers who are using Okta as their identity management solution. So the Okta Verify application is the driver behind this. If you use Okta to authenticate into your app, you can use this solution. And by federating identity through all of your applications, anything that you can use this kind of authentication with, you can use this process with. It's just it's literally just an evolution in the direction in which authorization against true identity is moving. So if you think about it, it's where zero trust is going. It's where all of the other thoughts about how you have really robust authentication are going. And in my view, it's also the answer to what really is defense in depth. Don't trust anything. Verify continuously. Make sure every single connection comes from a trusted source, and make sure that it's verified every single time.
So when is a source not trusted? So say someone, say I move to a different computer, but I'm coming from the same IP address. You know, what's the scenario there? I imagine it just kicks up for a password and second factor to authorize me. And then what, just, you know, you're then tied to that device. I mean, what's the thing that really makes this work? It sounds like it's the device profiling.
So it's the way the device is tied into the system makes the seamless flow. But as you say, if the conditions change, you have options. And exactly which options you implement depends on the policy that gets set. But you can push for a multi-factor challenge. So you can send out a different challenge, ask for additional credentials, and you can force that device to authenticate itself more formally so that you know that it's trusted. Or you can simply deny access and limit what the person is trying to access based on the fact that they're using an untrusted device. So that means you don't necessarily have to shut them out, but you can control it.
Mm.
So let's say the person is trying to access something simple, like, I don't know, the dinner menu at the company. You know, it probably doesn't matter that they pull out their own iPhone and go and access it. But if, on the other hand, they're trying to access Salesforce and they're trying to pull down sensitive customer information, you want to make sure that that authentication has been done firmly, that you know the identity of the person who's done it, and that it's completely attestable.
Yeah. Is there a risk with some of this stuff that people might YOLO it a little bit too much, and that might mean that, say, if an attacker is able to get onto one of these users' devices, they can just, you know, start authing to absolutely bloody everything without any, you know, interaction from them? Well, I mean, look, I suppose an owned endpoint is always bad, right? Because even if you're still using passwords, you can keylog them, right? I'm just trying to be contrarian.
So, I mean, that's the ultimate problem, right? You know, if you have a trusted device of any description and you have a bad guy that can mimic the legitimate user by piggybacking on that device's access, you're always going to have a challenge. But that's the reason why we're baking things like biometrics into this. So if you've got a bad guy who's now got control of a device with biometrics in it, and the authentication profile requires that you have something like, you know, your biometric authentication, your face, your fingerprint as a secondary part of this, or if you're using something like a YubiKey, then it gets a lot harder for the bad guy to piggyback, because there's an affirmative action that has to be taken by the user to confirm that to go forward.
There is. And I mean, you know, this stuff can be bypassed, but it's like, it's hard, right? I remember years ago seeing a write-up of, I think it was Chinese state-backed attackers who were going after some sort of US military target that was, you know, it was some DOD target, and they were using smart card auth, and they actually figured out how to piggyback based on smart card auths, right? And that was a cool paper, you know, but this isn't your typical idiot, is it? You know, like, you're not, this is pretty much expert level stuff at that point.
Yeah, I mean, so I have a history of breaking things like this. I broke the iPhone 5S Touch ID back when it first came out, and I wrote a paper that said, this is why I broke Touch ID, but still think it's awesome. Because at the end of the day, there's no such thing as perfect security. What you need is security that works, security that's enough to protect the risk profile that your company faces, and security that's not going to be a financial or logistical burden on top of your company.
Hmm.
And that's the idea behind this, is to make security that's strong enough that you are going to resist all but like the most extreme kind of actors. But at the same time, you're not putting an undue burden on the organization to either roll it out, to manage it, or to have it integrated with other systems and applications.
Yeah. No, look, it all makes a lot of sense. Sounds like certainly this is something that users are going to like. And given that it is Okta rolling it out, I'm guessing it's been done well. Mark Rogers, thank you very much for joining us to tell us all about that.
My pleasure.
That was Mark Rogers of Okta there. Big thanks to him for that. And you can check out Okta at okta.com, OKTA.com. Okay, it is time for our third and final snake oiler today. John Emmett of Kaseya is joining us. Kaseya makes software that's used by a lot of MSPs and medium-sized companies. And they're joining us today to promote their VSA Endpoint Management Agent. Now, I'm guessing a lot of you out there are looking for something like this. You're going to need something to manage the endpoints your staff are currently using from home. And now those endpoints are off the domain and in people's houses. How are you getting AV onto those boxes? How are you enforcing that? How are you doing remote support? How are you doing patching? What about backups? You know, all of that really standard endpoint management stuff that you would normally be doing inside your organization on your Windows domain. Kaseya's VSA agent is just one of those software tools that you can throw into your eval mix when you're looking at how to do this. And John Emmett came along to talk us through his pitch for Kaseya VSA, and here's what he had to say.
The way our technology works is we do deploy an agent to all the devices. So your laptop that you're now working from home on has an agent on it, Kaseya VSA's agent, and so we are able to access that device. We're able to run and execute what we call agent procedures, which are scripts that, you know, can run on that endpoint and do things like update your software, do patch management, things like that, so that you do keep those endpoints more secure.
Yeah. Yep. So just all of those basic functions of like installing software, patching software, et cetera, right?
Yeah. Installing, updating software, patching, and then being able to access that device, like I said, access that device remotely so that, you know, a tech can do remote control and access that device. And we actually have a couple of different ways that technicians can do that. Something that we call Live Connect, which is a sort of behind the scenes way to access the endpoint. So you could be working from your home office and have a problem on your laptop, and you know, you contact tech support and the tech says, oh, I need to, you know, remote into that device, and he can actually remote in behind the scenes while the user is still on their laptop, still working and trying to, you know, figure out what's wrong with that.
Less like remote hands with the, you know, mouse moving around the screen and stuff like that, and more just like they're working away in the background while one of your happy corporate workers is sitting there working in their productivity suites. That's excellent. So I'm assuming that this is sort of like, you know, all of these systems that have this management agent installed on them are calling back, you know, are being managed via the cloud somehow, right? So this isn't like your customers need to spin up some sort of management server in a data center. I'm guessing there are tenanted, you know, instances that you manage and people just get provision creds. Is that it?
Sure, it's available as a SaaS solution. So you do have, you know, the VSA server in the cloud, as you say. It's actually available both. So we do have some, you know, fairly large customers who have on-prem installations of VSA in their own data center environment. But you know, most customers these days buy the SaaS solution so that, you know, you can, you know, access it from anywhere kind of thing.
Yeah, so you don't have to worry about running it, basically. Now, look, you just mentioned this great functionality where, you know, support people can go and essentially, you know, be on those endpoints without the user actually knowing. How are you doing this in a way that's secure? I mean, you're obviously offering a way in to all of these endpoints for, you know, companies support people to be able to go into those endpoints. I mean, how are you handling the authentication, et cetera?
Yeah, so, yeah, we have built-in two-factor authentication in VSA so that when you log into VSA, you have to, you know, basically do the one-time passcode kind of thing. So we have that built into VSA as of last year. And that's actually pretty important because, as you say, and it's been in the media a few times over the last year or so, where MSPs have been hacked and hackers have been able to access their clients' environments through their remote monitoring and management tool. So that's certainly a problem, but two-factor authentication helps to alleviate that to some extent in terms of at least the login process.
You mentioned one-time passcodes. Is that via SMS, or you know, how are you doing that? Or is that via Google Authenticator? Is there YubiKey support? Like, what else have you got coming there?
Yeah, so you can use a couple of different authenticators, including Google and Microsoft authenticators.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, basically there's a component that's built in, but then it leverages those, you know, freely available authenticators so that you can, you know, easily set that up. You know, we have the agent on the endpoint and, you know, it can be managed from the VSA console, or you can manage it as actually when you're in the, you know, the remote control function on the endpoint as well. So there's a number of different ways that you can sort of manage that agent. And also, in terms of automation, another powerful capability that we have in the VSA product is what we call policy. So you can actually set up policies within the endpoint management tool that would guide the agent process. So in other words, how agents, you know, execute tasks on the endpoint. You can set up what we call policies to sort of manage that process. So that's, you know, there's sort of two key aspects to the automation component of VSA. And one is the agent being able to execute agent procedures or scripts, and then policies that kind of guide that process.
Now, I'm curious too, just since this whole crisis has kicked off, have you had many customers who are asking you to help them roll out your software onto employee-owned devices, or is that just something that's not happening? Because, you know, there's plenty of users out there who weren't normally issued with like company-supplied laptops who all of a sudden are working from home. How have your customers been handling that? Have they actually been moving some of the, you know, office-based hardware into people's homes? Have they been installing these agents on employee-owned hardware? Like, how have they handled that?
Yeah, so I don't know specifically. I haven't really been on the front lines in terms of talking to customers about that, but I would imagine that, like you say, there probably are customers who have, a BYOD policy, or ideally they would have some sort of BYOD policy, so that if they are using their desktop from their home, that you have a policy that says, hey, in order for us to allow you to use that for business purposes, we'd like to install our agent on that device. So the employee would have to sort of agree to that process, right? So as part of your BYOD policy, you'd say, this is what you need to do. If you're good with that, then we can install the agent, then we can control that device. We can access that device remotely so that we can help you troubleshoot issues. We can make sure that it's secure by deploying and updating the antivirus.
So you're not sure. You're not sure if this is something that's happening, but if it were to happen, that would be a way to get it done, I guess, is what you're saying.
Yeah. So there's actually two things you could do. So that's one way to go, is have a BYOD policy and then actually deploy the agent to the device so that you can manage it and access it and troubleshoot it and all that, as we've discussed. And then the second thing that you can do, again, from your RMM or endpoint management tool, is you can actually enable the remote worker to use the endpoint management tool, in this case VSA, to securely access a machine back at the office. So they could go on their home computer and you could set them up with sort of a remote user role within VSA. And with that remote user role, you're giving them certain capabilities within the product. And one of those capabilities could be, okay, now you can remote it back into a device that's in the office that you couldn't bring home, let's say. And you can do that securely through VSA. You can access it, in a secure manner through the endpoint management solution.
Now, I'd imagine, too, that over the last couple of months, you would have seen a lot more interest in these types of products. What type of organizations are, expressing interest here? Is it, because I think you mentioned sort of small to medium business, but in the United States, a medium enterprise is a lot bigger than what we call a medium enterprise in Australia. But, what are the sort of desktop counts for the types of organizations that are the typical customer during the pandemic?
Yeah, so for us, our typical customer is probably in the, if you're not being served by an MSP, then you're probably in the, few hundred endpoints to up to maybe 2,500 endpoint kind of range is kind of our sweet spot.
Yeah.
The type of customer that, uses our technology.
Yeah, I think it's sort of 500 to 2,500 feels like about what the US considers medium, right?
Yeah, it's in that range. That would be kind of the size of, the type of organization that would use this kind of technology and that, in this, environment that we're in today would find it, very useful.
Yeah. Now, I understand also that you handle backups with this agent. How does that work in a work from home context where someone's working on their home internet connection and you've got a backup solution? What are you sucking up the entire contents of their hard drive into your cloud? I mean, how is that going to work?
So we have a couple of different solutions, and typically, you wouldn't be so worried about sucking up all the contents of the laptop into the cloud, but we do have a direct-to-cloud backup solution that allows you to back up the endpoint as needed to a cloud. And then we have an appliance that would be on the on-prem side of things, which would be more of your server backup solution.
John Emmett, thank you very much for joining us on Snake Oilers to talk through your technology and how it can assist people who all of a sudden have a work from home workforce. I wish you all the best with it. And we'll talk to you again, I'm sure.
All right. Thank you.
That was John Emmett of Kaseya there. Big thanks to him for that. And you can check out Kaseya at kaseya.com. That's Kaseya.com. And I've dropped a link through to the VSA demo request page in the show notes for this podcast. I do hope you find that useful. And that is it for this edition of the Snake Oilers podcast. I do hope you've enjoyed it. I'll be back next week with another regular edition of the Risky Business podcast. But until then, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.